Welcome to the Almost Reckless podcast. I'm Amy Smilovic, and my guest today is Frances Schumach, founder and CEO of Abel Fragrance.
And she came in just to visit with us. No, not really, but to do other things.
Why wouldn't I, though?
So I love having you here today. And full disclosure, sometimes before these podcasts, I like really having a long conversation with people ahead of time so I can feel by the time we hit the couch, we really know each other. But when we spoke like 10 minutes in, I was like, I need to hang up the phone because
you did.
It's very organic.
We got straight into like the deep things.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I want to share that with people today, and I want it to come out in the most natural format possible, which I know that it will. So how long ago did you start Abel?
Yeah, we're 12 years this year.
So and where were you living when you...
Amsterdam.
In Amsterdam.
Yeah, so from New Zealand, my husband and I moved up to Amsterdam. Quite a lot of New Zealanders tend to flee the country at a certain age. And, you know, it's a wonderful place to live, New Zealand, but you're so far from the rest of the world, you know. So I just really wanted to be in Europe. Didn't think I'd stay up there 10 years and have two children up there, but I just loved it.
So what were you doing before you started Abel?
So I from school, I studied viticulture and enology at university, which is
winemaking.
So viticulture is vineyards, making, growing grapes, and enology is wine science. So yeah, I spent my early career in winemaking.
And so how did the pivot to fragrance come about?
When I moved to Holland, nobody moves there to make wine. It's a real beer culture. But I was kind of ready to, you know, try something different. It was all that I'd known. And not long after moving to Europe, we were doing, you know, as you do when you move to Europe and you're an hour flight or train ride from anywhere, discovering what Europe has to offer. And I really started to fall in love with this. At the time, this is 15 or more years ago, like emerging world of niche artisan perfume making, which was, you know, before that, my exposure to fragrance. I've always loved fragrance, but it was kind of celebrity endorsed, billboards, and, you know, whereas you'd go to like a beautiful little atelier and there'd be one perfume house and perhaps a sculptor. And I just really fell in love with that emotional connection to fragrance and art. That's where it came.
Wow. And I mean, falling in love with it, but feeling like I can do this.
Yeah.
I can have a business.
That's a stretch.
Did you always want to have your own business?
Perhaps. I grew up on a farm. My mum's a yoga teacher, so my parents were both business people in a sense. So I kind of grew up, I've never been very good at being told what to do.
Did so you get in trouble in school?
No, no. I was quite a good girl at school, I would say, but non-conformist perhaps. And yeah, look, this the trigger moment for me, I fell in love with this perfume world as a consumer. So I was buying and I was smelling and I was trying. And the trigger for me was that the more I learned about it, the more I kind of questioned why is no one working with natural, sustainable ingredients and ethical supply chain. And so that's really where the kind of moment happened for me.
And because certainly when you started, like no one was doing this.
There was the odd, like, I would say like old school pioneer, let's say, that perhaps no longer exists anymore. But there was no one doing it in any kind of modern way, you know, and in a luxury way, in a way that, you know, perfume is one of life's joyful pleasures. You know, you wear it to feel good, to feel confident, to kind of it's an extension of your personality and your style.
And did you start mixing things up, or did you think I need to get an expert in right away to bring this vision to life?
Yeah, the latter. I had probably enough kind of naivety to think wine, perfume, you know, there's a lot of similarities. To kind of think, oh, maybe this is something I can do, but not so much that I thought I could do it without bringing in, you know, the real experts. So finding a master perfumer was really my first point of call.
Was it difficult explaining to a master perfumer that you had this new vision for what perfume
could
be?
It would have been. Yeah, it's a really good question. It would have been, except I found myself an incredible kind of ally.
Yeah.
So there's only around 50 master perfumers or so in the world.
Uh-huh.
Claim to fame is less than astronauts.
Wow.
And when I was searching for someone, honestly, like the, you know, it was a lot of older Italian, French men. Italian, French, older men, primarily. And I thought, exactly that. They're not going to take this young Kiwi woman with no background in the industry seriously.
Yeah.
And then I came across a video of this young New Zealand master perfumer, Isaac Sinclair. And he was standing in the New Zealand native bush. And I'm a very, like, naturist. I don't know if that's a word. And he was talking about how perfume is like wine.
Yeah.
I kid you not. And
Harry,
so that
this
was
is
like,
kismet.
Yeah, eureka.
Yeah.
I was like, here's my guy. And so we've been working together 15 years now.
So, you know, if I find it's interesting, like for us with clothing, it's the same thing. Like you need to find the tailor who is so excellent at his
craft,
imagine. But also is willing to throw away everything he knows and suspend it in order to like envision something new. And it's very hard to find. It's really hard to find.
Because it's also difficult. It's something I'm really aware of as I get older, is ensuring that I'm open to new ideas and new ways of doing things.
Yep.
Because you just see yourself. If you're not, you fall into patterns, right?
Yeah.
I know how this works.
Yeah.
Do you? Is there another way, you know? And
yeah.
I think it probably helped that Isaac was young-ish, you know. I think he was late 30s at the time, or a bit younger, and from New Zealand. So we're a young country. We're not ingrained in those kind of traditions that often come with an older culture.
Yeah.
And just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to do a lot of relearning as well. So the cool thing now is more and more people are entering the space.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at what we've learned during this journey.
Mm-hmm.
We've really had to rewrite the playbook for how you make fragrance.
So you 100% independent when you started this company, right? And you've taken some investment dollars now, right? How long did you go without having investors?
Yeah. Yeah. And you asked, like, did I always want to be a business owner? Perhaps that comes into it.
Yeah.
There was never like a funding strategy, you know. It was just that I, again, naively was like, someone needs to do this, you know, and I would love to do this. And maybe this could be my life's work.
So did you start with a business plan?
Like of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite a process planner type person. So it wasn't just like seat of the pants. You know, let's just do this without any planning.
Yeah.
But
if you assume you at some point you actually did do a business plan, if you have investors, did that business plan look like the business plan that you would have written when you started, or did it evolve over the years where you thought you were going to go with it?
Yeah. I mean, we've always had a pretty consistent North Star around like, how can we mobilize and shift this industry and prove what's possible with nature? So that's never changed. I've always wanted to be, have a global presence. That's always been really important to me. We were never going to just, you know, try to be a Dutch brand at the time.
Right.
Like, so I think we opened up our first export market in the first year. So we started trading in Germany quite quickly. So I think in a way, not a lot. I mean, it always changes a little bit, but
I'm curious though, because I love the concept of a North Star. And I, when I talk with people, especially entrepreneurs, I always tell them, you know, kind of lead every day as if you are working with a compass rather than GPS, because GPS is very prescriptive, right? Like take a left turn, go 2 miles. But a compass gives you comfort to meander and play around, but you know which way you're
That's
focused
such a
in
nice
what direction.
Reference.
And but I think sometimes it's hard for people to find which direction they need their compass in and what their North Star is. So when you say you had a North Star, was that something pulling you towards something, or could you articulate really what that North Star meant to you at the time?
I think we articulated it at the time. It was probably a little bit more defensive. So when I first started out, it was like I wanted to prove it was possible, you know? And so I think maybe that's the shift, is like, we're not trying to prove anything now. We're trying to bring people with us, you know? And I think so little nuances like that changed, for sure. But no, we did articulate it. Yeah.
It's funny that you, when you put it that way, that it was defensive, because when I started Tibby, I found that we were always defining ourselves by what we weren't. We were like, well, we're not one of those luxury brands, and we're not a girly brand. And it really starts to beg the question at some point, then what are you?
Yeah. And way harder to define.
Way harder. And especially when there's no hook to just hang your hat on. When you're really creating something new, it's very hard to define what you are. And I think one of what we found was one of the real difficulties in defining what we were was because we were defining it in terms of business terms rather than what we wanted for ourselves out of life.
Yeah.
And once we did that, that's when our compass came into clarity.
Became clear. Yeah. By the way, side note, but I think you're creative pragmatist. That resonates with me as a person so much. So I don't know how much that's part of the kind of guiding principle for your life, but I think for your community.
Yeah.
It's incredibly mobilizing.
I mean, it started there because it was my old marketing director. He came in, his name was Emeka, and he, or is Emeka, and he came in and he said, make up a name. If you, if you're having this much of an issue, you know, at this, this point, 20 years into our lifespan, make it up. And he was like, it doesn't have to mean anything. And when he left, I thought, yes, make up a name, but I do want it to mean something. And I thought everything we design is for someone that is creative and pragmatic. And so I think giving names to things, when you're in this environment that has no industry, it's still unsettling if you don't know, if you don't have ground beneath you, you know, it's unsettling. And it's important, I think, for team members to know which way they're headed as well. So
that's a really important sentence.
Yeah.
You just said, yeah, yeah.
It's really critical because it's kind of like when you talked about the perfume expert that you ended up working with. You have to constantly be taking all that expertise and knowledge and applying it towards something that is comfortably ambiguous, but you know is going to lead to something great.
Yeah.
And
that can be more comfortable as a leader because you know you've got exposure to everything.
Yeah.
Whereas someone a little bit further down in the company who's only exposed to one thing, you know, it can feel wobbly almost, you know, if it's not. Yeah.
And it feels, and for employees who are joining a company, it's wobbly too, because if you know that you're going to do your best work when you know how to work cross-functionally and you know how, what's important in your company, I think so many people believe that, like, okay, well, if I'm going to learn how to work cross-functionally, I need exposure to finance, marketing, sales, you know, and the boxes. But again, it's not just having all those boxes are like a data set of information, but it's still knowing what is your company's North Star. Like, what are you working
what
towards?
What ties it all together?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I'm like, your team is obviously much bigger than mine.
How big is your team?
12.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, our head office is in Wellington in New Zealand, where I live. Super important that I'm in the head office. And then we have a satellite team in Amsterdam and New York.
And what functions do you outsource?
Good question.
To like shipping or is shipping
yes,
outsourced?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we have warehousing in New York, Amsterdam, UK and New Zealand. Yeah. But New Zealand, that's in-house.
Yeah.
Logistical things, operational things, anything that requires really specialist.
Yeah.
Kind of attention, let's say, or deep tech or deep R&D.
Yeah.
We try to stay really close to that.
Yeah.
But I've kind of found, you know, you can't spread yourself too thin.
What does R&D look like for you?
For us, yeah. I mean, we're working on a huge R&D project at the moment. It will be in the market in September. It's about ingredients. Obviously, the formula for our fragrances, working with the perfumers. Packaging is a really big one. It's probably a little bit of a known fact these days, but, you know, packaging, there's so many issues with single use, et cetera.
Yeah.
But also in the fragrance industry, it can be 90% of the product cost is the packaging.
That's crazy.
It's gross, right?
It's really, it's really crazy.
Yeah. I mean, probably more, by the way, as well. I remember sitting at one point years ago with brand founders and someone saying, what? You spend more money on your perfume than your packaging? And I thought, what? Everybody else doesn't?
No, like, it's exactly.
Yeah.
And how, so I'm curious in terms of like what investment goes into a product. Like, at what point does your incremental value or whatever in let me think how
like
to say
this. Like economies of scale, perhaps? Or
well, okay, so in Tibby analogy, we use luxury fabrications. They might run anywhere from $50 to $120 a yard, let's say. Sometimes the difference between a fabric that is $120 a yard and $180 a yard would be so minimal, but the difference between a fabric that is $15 a yard and $50 a yard is astronomical in terms of like what you get out of it, the luxuriousness and the feel. So there's a sweet spot where you have a lot of luxury, a lot of value packed in, and then there's that spot that when the prices get too much higher, it really is no longer
no
worth
payoff
it.
For the, yeah.
But there's an absolute certain amount that you must pay in order to get something great.
Fragrance, I would say, is not quite as linear. So I think we talk about, so we work with only natural derived ingredients.
Right.
And the converse of that is petrochemical derived ingredients.
Yeah.
And we're very black and white. I don't want to be part of fossil fuel supply chain. But there's just dramatically huge price difference in ingredients that come from nature versus petrochemicals. So we're talking some of our...
Higher or lower?
Way high. I mean, it's like silk versus polyester. I'm not close to it, but that's kind of... And so things like iris butter, which is just such a beautiful ingredient grown in France,
it's
harvested from the bulbs and dried over 5 years. That is, you know, 20,000 euros per kilo.
Yeah. Wow.
And iris, a molecule from fossil fuels that smells a bit like an iris.
Yeah.
Might be $50 per kilo.
Wow.
So we're talking like just exponential.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing in the fragrance industry is there is no transparency.
Yeah.
So if you're using real iris or this petrochemical molecule.
The label says iris.
The label says iris.
Wow.
Insane, right?
So you have to really know who you're buying from?
You do.
I mean, like me as a consumer, I need to know.
Yeah. I mean, we put our ingredients list on our, on our website, because I think you deserve to know.
Yeah.
If you put like a food analogy, like if you're buying truffle oil, you want to know it's real truffle oil before you spend $100 on a bottle.
Sure.
And I think it's the same with perfume, but.
So how, you know, it's interesting. And I know you've been in business long enough to see this, but I remember there was all this buzz 10 years ago where people were like, people are one day going to really care who they're buying from. And you're like, well, you know, should we focus on an about us section on a website? Does anyone ever really go there? And you know, one of the things that we do so much of is, you know, we very much lean on our own behaviors to figure out what we think the customer's behavior will be. Because as a small company that's not looking to scale and dominate the world, we can do that, right? There's enough people that look like us around the world. And if I get some of them, we're good to go. And I don't buy anything anymore unless I know who it is that I'm buying from. It is so important to me. And it's funny because I feel like it's very important to a lot of people. And then I feel like a lot of people believe that it's very important, but then they'll click on like an Instagram ad in 2 seconds and buy from whomever.
Yeah, I mean, we're not. I love how disciplined you are, and I try to be as well. Occasionally I'll annoy myself where you know, will impulse buy something. I think, oh, I forgot to check the you know, the care label or something, because, and I very rarely impulse buy, to be honest, but I think it is really important. Mm-hmm. And I think you personally are your biggest brand ambassador, I think. And we'd certainly get that feedback from our customers as well. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this thing going around in the fashion world where all the design houses have almost all of them have change creative directors. And I was telling our Sarah, our brand director, I was like, you know, it's interesting because we're going to Paris and there's nothing that I'm really craving to buy, because now all of a sudden, like, Loewe might not be J.W. Anderson anymore. And Jill Sander is no longer the Jill Sander designers anymore. Like, they've all been uprooted, and it feels very much like just random labels floating around that are connected to big houses, but there's no human face.
I totally
to them.
Agree. I mean, I'm not fashion industry, so I don't, I'm not so close to it, but from the outside, yeah, it feels...
Because you would think with something quite tangible, like clothing, like either you could like it or you don't, it's not that simple. There's so much more on what people put into things. And I'm wondering, like, from your world perspective, like the checkbox, I want to know who I'm buying from. What are the other checkboxes that a customer looks at when they're buying a scent? You know, what...
Yeah, I mean, I think most importantly is the scent.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it's the same with clothing. Yeah. Like, you actually really want to connect with that fragrance.
Is there a way to get someone to connect to something if they don't connect to it right away in the scent world? Like, is there any explaining that could change their mind?
Maybe. We hear all the time. So we always try. I never want anyone to buy a perfume without trying it on their skin.
Yeah.
And we do little trial sizes, which work really well for digital customers. But even in stores, people, it's a pretty brutal environment to try something sensory in a store.
Yeah.
You know, especially if the lighting is not and the music, you know, all of these things. I always say, get it home. Get it on your skin, in your home environment, and see if it speaks to you, because it's so personal.
It's so personal. And it's funny because this was maybe like 15 years ago, and it was the Saks Fifth Avenue store in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I went in specifically to buy, it was when Margiela had just come out with the Untitled cologne. And I went in and I said, I want to buy this, please. And the woman said, oh, I have something so much better for you. And she's like, this scent is very popular. It's being worn by all of the stars. And I remember I was like, who are these stars? And she started listing off like Cindy Crawford, Stephanie Seymour, which first of all, this was not the late 80s. This was 2010. So I was like, wow, this is surreal. But it was interesting that I came in, I knew what I wanted. I smelled it. I loved it.
She talked you out of it.
And she was trying to talk me out of it and tell me what Cindy Crawford had been wearing all these years. And I just thought that was such a confusing way to sell something to aspire to be Cindy Crawford.
Was she a salesperson for the other brand or?
I don't know. She was just like behind the counter. But it was, it just seemed so bizarre to me that I would want to smell like a person rather than like something I know.
But I think there was really a decade or more of that, you know, and the scent marketing was all, you know, beautiful lady on the bridge in Paris, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was you spray it on your skin and you will look like her. I don't know.
I feel like what happened?
Or the guy gazing up at her.
Yes.
So I think we're moving beyond that. Uh-huh. Or certainly that's had no part. We actually never put a face on. We have still never really, unless it's an interview with a person, ever shared a face in any of our, you know, social media marketing, anything. It's always, you know, you might see an arm or a shoulder or, you know, but the thinking being this is the emotional place in which we want you to, you know, kind of delve into.
Yeah.
We're not trying to sell you a look.
Well, it's, I mean, to that point though, it's funny because even on our own site, we ended up chopping the heads off of the models because it was too specific. Once you had the face on, I wanted someone to just imagine how this sweater would feel on them.
That's what it should be about,
wondering,
right?
Like, do I need blonde hair or red hair or whatever to wear it, you know?
Yeah.
So you started this company because you had a gut that this would work, right? You were feeling for something. How often do you make decisions based from your gut now?
Now, and this year, it's almost like a personal mantra for me, is trust my gut.
And what has ever rocked your world and made you not trust your gut? What are the things that happen that have caused you to, or do you never?
No, I do. I definitely do. There's been times in the last decade often, and perhaps it comes from, you know, a disagreement with someone whose opinion you respect.
Yeah.
And there's no, yes. I think maybe it's accepting that, you know, that's your way, this is my way. We fucking have no idea whose way is right, you know, but perhaps die on your own sword.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a little bit where I'm. What is your North Star as a founder?
Yeah.
What's super important to you as you grow this business? And you'll make mistakes, but make your own mistakes, not someone else's.
When I am so much happier when I've made my own mistakes. I'm really mad at myself.
That's okay.
But
we're not as bad as being mad at yourself and not trusting.
Yeah. For not trusting your gut. So when you said that, you, the times that you've questioned your gut is because it's someone that you respected, maybe that offered a contrarian view. When it's someone that you respected, is it because you respected their knowledge of the industry? You respected them really so much as a human? Like, where was the respect?
Both, I think. And the different people, different occasions. There's been the odd time where I've gone against my entire team.
Yeah.
For example, you know, and where I've said, you know, no, we're not doing this.
Yeah.
And everyone goes, you're crazy. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've been wrong, but there's been a couple of occasions last year where, you know, I've looked back and gone, yeah, it's the accumulation of little things that you look back and you go, oh, I had an instinct. Four iterations back, or
so the big things that could go wrong, you know, especially when you don't trust your gut. I mean, for me, when things have gone really wrong, so it's usually out of ignorance just, I didn't know what I didn't know at the time, right? And that was in the beginning, you know, there were like fit issues and things like that. But I was very angry at myself for not, like, my husband always told me, he's like, hope is not a strategy. You can't just hope that the clothing fits. You need to actually be doing things to make sure that you know this. And, but I think one of the things that I wanted to ask you is in terms of like trusting your gut, but then also, you know, you're running a company. And it's not like you can just walk in every time and be like, guys, here's my gut. We're running with it, right? Like, you want to sell in your idea to them because, number one, you need buy-in for them to really get behind it and do their job. And number two, you've hired really good people. You need them to poke at it, right? And
totally
make sure that gut is really solid. And it was interesting. I was reading a really good article the other day, and I screenshot it because it was directed towards junior people in companies. And it said, are you tired of being shot down by your team leader or your CEO because you bring them an idea and you get the immediate like, no. And they were saying how to start peppering in your concept, your idea, start really paving that ground for like weeks ahead of time, so that when you present it to the team leader, to the president, whoever, that number one, they can almost feel like it was their idea too. Like, I've been thinking the exact same thing. Or you've established an argument that is clear enough that if it is a hallway conversation, you can be like, hey, you know what? These three things have come up that I've been talking about over the last few weeks, and therefore I think. And so I had screenshot that and I sent it out to our team for marketing because I thought, even when I'm talking to the customer and I'm trying to get them to understand why it's important that they try a larger size pant because of the ease and the comfort, I'm not just going right out of the gate and being like, guys, here's our oversized pant and wear this and you'll look cool in it. Usually over months, I'm saying, guys, don't you want to feel like more chill? Don't you want to feel more eased out? And then it's like, oh, wait, here's the pant that does that for you. You really have to set the scene. So I'm curious, when you had a gut instinct, I find that's one of the hardest things is to stop and pause and unpack what is leading up to it so you really can effectively sell it in
to others. Yeah, it's a really good line of thought. And also, perhaps just to be clear, there's plenty of things where I think, oh, you know what? I'm not close enough to this. I trust your gut. You know, actually, I don't have enough context. You've been in this for, you know, a long time. And certainly if my gut's not telling me something strong, I'd prefer one of the team to take. Because it's also empowering, right? And if they, you know, it's not about failure per se, but it is about giving them a chance to make mistakes and learn as well. If they don't ever get to run with something, they don't ever get a chance to make a mistake.
So,
on their own terms.
When you hire people, how long do they need to usually be around before you,
what do you think,
can trust their gut? Because sometimes, you know, I will hire someone new and in 2 months they'll come in and they're like, hey, listen, my gut is telling me. And I'm like,
I don't know your gut yet.
no gut for you yet. You might have good taste, but you don't have a gut yet. How does like an employee get a gut?
Yeah, I mean, look, our longest standing employee has been with me for 10 of the 12 years. And it was just me for those first 2 years. So I trust her gut. And that's, you know, really, I love having people around me who and because you also get a read on their gut. You go, I trust your gut on these things, but maybe not these. Or, you know, so.
I don't know if there is sometimes it's going to be some things and not.
Not others.
Not others.
And it's also knowing where your gut's strong.
Yeah.
And not. Because there are some areas where I think, oh, my gut, given what I know about myself, given where I know my kind of weaknesses lie, I don't want to listen to my gut in some areas, you know, whether it's things where I lack a bit of confidence or things where perhaps we have a saying in New Zealand, tall poppy syndrome, which is where if you put your head above the parapet as a poppy, you're likely to get it lopped off. So
I like that visual.
The visual. The Dutch have a saying, it's very similar as well. I don't think it's sort of
both
very American.
From flowery type,
I don't think it's an American saying. I'm very aware that I have that tendency.
Yeah.
Don't put my head up. And so I kind of question my gut if it's telling me to, you know, pull back, be quiet. So that's kind of a personal area that I'm aware of.
Well, I think what gave us the freedom to follow our gut more was when we relieved ourselves from the belief that we had to scale. And, you know, when we came to the realization that this company is made up of people, it is deeply personal. And if it was about our mindset, then the minute that we didn't follow our own mindset, we would be in really unfamiliar terrain. And why to go there? Because we're not aiming for a $300 million valuation or anything like that. And so I needed that bar set to really be able to trust my gut.
It comes back to your North Star, your principles that you were talking about earlier, right?
And I think that that's where a lot of, I think, entrepreneurs right now live in a bit of a confused state because, you know, you watch Shark Tank, you're supposed to everything is supposed to be about scaling. And, you know, ideas are incubated in a Stanford classroom rather than by anyone living their life in Amsterdam thinking, why are there no organic perfumes out there, right? And so you can see why there is this real crisis of confidence, because if I had to worry about attracting people to us who think nothing like me, of course I would never have a gut. And I need
and
people
need
who are really good on numbers.
And you need lived experiences for gut. And you need to make mistakes and learn from them. And you don't get any of that from a classroom. It's not to downplay education at all. But I think where we're coming from is that the gut's been... I probably should know a bit more about the science behind it, but it is cell memory, right? And it's cell memory from things that, you know, a gut instinct, it's actually your subconscious informing from all of the things you know. We can't potentially put a finger on exactly what, but it's all of those experiences that come together to give us what we would call our gut instinct.
It's everything that comes together. And then it's one thing then to have a gut and know that you have a gut, but it's a fully a different thing to actually trust your gut. And one of the things that I found is by writing things out, I have found it really helpful to stop and like when I'm getting a gut sense for something, to really understand. I wrote this out because I didn't want to bungle this when we were talking. I really wanted to understand when I'm getting that gut feeling, what is happening when I'm feeling the gut? What's happening around me? Then writing out, what is it that I thought would happen? And then eventually getting the chance to write out what actually did happen.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to do that to kind of codify
systemizing it, isn't it?
To systematize it, and not so much in the vein of trying to build a better gut, but just trying to pump myself up to trust my gut.
Yeah, and something you said there that I really liked was, what was the place in which you were in that your gut told you something? Because I quite often will find after meditation. For example, after a really good yoga class, I'll jump on my bike and I'll go, that's what I should do. And that's
it's
where
so
it comes
annoying
from,
though, when
right?
It happens too. And you're, for me, it's bar class or the shower.
Yeah.
And I have to find a way to write when the paper's really wet.
But don't you feel like, I feel like if you have that kind of realization, you don't forget it though either.
Yeah.
It's like crystallized.
Well, I'm like Dory, that fish, and I will forget it. And I'm like,
jump out of the shower.
And I literally do. Like, I'll find a paper package from a package of razors and a pen, and I'll write on the corner.
Yeah,
and,
love it.
But it's funny
it's
because it just
space.
Comes to you.
Yeah, hun, and it might be something that you'd almost parked.
Yeah.
You know, you'd almost thought, you know, 2 weeks ago, I'm not even sure. And I read a really nice quote. I'm not going to remember it, but it was something about like the value in procrastinating on complex problems.
Yes.
That actually sometimes it's okay. We think we need to solve everything now.
Yeah.
There is a case for parking something.
Yeah.
And letting it just, you know, revisit. Don't forget about it, but just park it. Whether it's let your subconscious work on it or let the kind of universe conspire to bring you some more data points or signs or something.
I know. I'm always, well, my husband's very type A, right? Okay. And he
so
needs
is
to
mine.
Be. Listen, and my husband, he's in charge of the numbers. He's got all the legal contracts. Like, you better, you
Great.
Need to be type
you want
A.
That
like,
person.
Different skill sets for different things. But there are so many times where I'm like, I promise I'm not procrastinating on this. I just
giving
know
space.
That, I don't have the information at hand to really like make this as good as it wants to be. And
that comes back to your question about like the rush, right?
Yeah.
If the North Star is growth at all costs,
time is money. Exactly. Like,
so but if that's not the North Star, if it's part of the equation, and for most of us it
has to be, right?
I mean, absolutely. You've got bills to pay, people, and I've always said like sustainable business is sustainable business too, right?
Yes.
But if that's the only focus,
then
you can't afford to sit and wait.
Yeah.
But if it's one part of the equation, and sometimes just a little bit of space is all you need, I think.
Yeah, it was funny. We had this big aha moment yesterday. And I know I love it when we have a moment where we come up with an idea that had we presented the idea 6 months ago, even, or a year ago, people would have thought it was insane. And that's one of the things I do to test an idea is, like, I immediately silo people and I'm like, what if and this and what if that and then so this. Yesterday we had this moment where I walked this idea around to like six different people who immediately, including my husband, were like, whoa, yes, this feels so right. And it was so exciting to have something that 6 months or a year ago, people would have been like, get out of my office. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard of.
And want to get more about this idea.
I can't wait to reveal it. And I was talking with Reed, who is our art director. And I was like, you know what, Reed? Remember when we were in San Miguel 3 years ago and I took these pictures? And he was like, whoa. So he's like, wait, so was this in your mind back then? And I was like, it wasn't, but it was.
Yeah.
And I described marinating on things kind of like a surrealist painting, which is like not a surrealist painting, but pointillism, where what's his name? The A Day in the Park or whatever. It's in the Chicago Museum. Seurat is a, I mixed it pointillism. And then Seurat is one of the famous painters who did the gigantic like walk in the park. It's in the Chicago Museum of Art.
Look it up.
And what I love about pointillism, I find it to be such an apt analogy because you're really you're collecting dots and you're just putting them on the canvas. And then that moment of meditation, the shower, is when you're able to step back and see what all those dots what it's the picture so, is yeah. that's been created.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I love it when the dots come together. It's so exciting.
And you may have looked at those same dots. How many times?
A million times.
And they might have looked like they were taking shape, because that's also with the trusting the gut sometimes, right? It's almost not quite fully formed. Like, maybe I'm seeing something. And then you know when it's crystal clear. You know when you've like seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things that was our game changer, and we were kind of alluding to this earlier, was, you know, as a company, when we realized that it was not about business principles that we were working towards, but more of life principles, do you feel like you're at, like, do you feel like you've got that locked down for you?
I don't feel like I've got anything locked down. Maybe never will.
Because I'm curious about that comment that you don't feel like you have things locked down, because in our 28 years, it is only in the last 4 years that I felt like we've known who we are. And I know it because we haven't questioned it in 4 years. We haven't changed it. And so it takes a while, but getting those principles down really secured that for us.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, look, I feel like I have a clear vision for who I want the business to be. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have a clear vision for who I want to be.
Yeah.
And how I want to show up at work and at home. But would I say anything is locked down? No. I mean, maybe never will be, although I hear you say that and I think, oh, I would like to aspire to that. But I also love a little bit of curiosity, perhaps.
Well, I think the thing about first principles are, though, is that it doesn't lock you down. I was thinking today with a conversation that I was having over DMs, and it made me kind of crystallize this to her. I was like, when I know someone's principles, I don't necessarily know what their opinions will be on everything. But when I know someone's opinions on everything, I rarely know their principles.
That's really nice.
And I was responding to that because she was like, you never talk about this or this or this on your Instagram. I was like, you're right, I don't, but I always talk about my principles. And so that's the beauty of first principles, is that you have this ability to defend your ideas or recognize when you've put something bad out there that really is against your principles. The key is that you know it. You have a way to measure.
Yeah, and maybe to your point right back at the start that you've verbalized it as well.
Yeah.
Are your family and your business principles, are they one and the same, or are they?
They are now.
They are.
They used to be separate. And when after COVID, what we just really decided to write out was that we always had to have agency, meaning our mistakes would be our own and our wins would be our own as well. We decided that we could only work with people who shared a similar mindset, and that the mindset was around curiosity and being open-minded and having a modern way of thought. And then the last one was that we would only create things that had meaning to us. And that was critical, because we all knew that we were kind of workaholics in a way. We knew that we couldn't shut down. And there's a difference when you can't shut down, but you don't have meaning in what you're doing versus, you know, and so then you're angry when you can't shut down. And we didn't want to be angry about what we were doing. So as long as we had meaning, as long as we had agency, as long as we were always surrounded by people that shared our mindset, we thought we'll be good. And that applies to real life and to work life. And it has been so, so at our core that every decision that we have made now, when we get a phone call from an investor, when we get a phone call with a brand that wants to partner, when we get a phone call from a store that wants to carry us, when we get an irate message from a customer who's furious about the way something fit or the way that it was, we charged her for shipping, or I don't know, whatever it is. If those three principles are compromised at all, the answer is so clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wow, we used to debate. I mean, before COVID, we'd sit there and we'd like, we want to work with this department store, but they're asking for this and blah.
That's exhausting.
It's exhausting.
Yeah. And you're right. It's the same in the home.
Yeah.
If you're constantly debating, you know, as a parent.
Yep.
What's good or bad or right or wrong and how are we involved or not? Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, as I've been writing a lot, I was thinking how nowhere in our household did we, growing up, have a list of rules for my sister and I. My friends did growing up in the South. Parents had rules. You were supposed to be yes, ma'am, no, sir. In our house, there was no yes, ma'am. There was no, sir. Like, no sirs, ma'ams. My parents, if you look at them, they were total hippies. They were 22 when they had me, 24 when they had my sister. They are so principle-based. We did not have any rules, yet by far our household was the strictest household.
Yeah.
Because you just knew.
Yeah.
You knew what was right and what was wrong, and you did not transgress. And when you did, you knew it, you know?
Yeah.
And I never got to say that wasn't a rule. My parents would be like, Amy, you know that you stayed out way too late.
You're
you know that you left
yourself.
Us and without information. You knew this was wrong. Go to your room.
But don't you think the rules just encourage breaking?
Well, it's like I was saying, if I know your principles, I don't have to know all your opinions, right?
It is the same. Yeah. And
a list of rules are like random opinions. They're memes. They don't mean anything.
I was even thinking when you were talking about in the home, like, I often get asked, like, how do you make your children eat everything?
Yeah.
Because mine eat, you know, blue cheese, olives, whatever, a sip of wine. I don't know if I should say that on this, but I've never told them they have to eat anything.
Yes.
You know, and so they've just always eaten with us. And they just, you know, it's never, ever been a point of contention.
Yeah.
I've never had to tell them to finish their food or anything because it's just, I don't know. I think if we had have ever done that, it just gives something to push against.
Yeah.
So there's never been any tension.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how being so loose can actually be so defining at the same time.
Yeah. Well, and then the beauty is it frees up so much space for everything else, right?
Yeah. And so I just think, you know, when you are running a company, there is so much value to intentionally staying small. And I see no value in intentionally only working to be big because, But that is the mantra out there.
Yeah, it's also why you're doing it. So we asked, when we did take on investment, one of the reasons we did is that we want to mobilize this industry.
Yeah.
And we want to change it.
Yeah.
And we realized that as an organically growing small business from New Zealand.
Yeah.
That may never happen.
Yeah.
It might take 300 years. And I have a very long-term view.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to work with, you talked about like outsourcing.
Yeah.
We really wanted to be as close to our customers as possible.
Yeah.
Which means not using middlemen, which we were doing a lot more of in the early days. And so for us, one of the reasons we want to grow is because we want to have an impact. I know it sounds like trite, but it really is. You know, I see on TikTok.
I would have said it was trite 4 years ago, but I don't
know. You know, the oh my God, the most amazing under the radar perfume. And it's cool to be under the radar. And I like that.
Yeah.
But actually, I want more and more people to say, what? I'm putting petrochemicals on my skin.
Yes.
And now there's like the science we're working with is so cool. The biotechnology, upcycled ingredients that are literally coming from food waste.
Yeah.
And I'm like, we can show that we don't need to be a fragrance doesn't need to be a fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
But we want to lead that change. And so then there's that, like, is it growth for the sake of growth or is it growth for the sake of like a better reason maybe? And so that was it for me.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, the idea that we were playing around with here yesterday would require some very smart investment, you know, and because there are things, of course, you know, when I think about taking risk and everything, my right now, my risk, my appetite for risk has to be also measured against the what's the worst that could go wrong if it were to go off the rails, right?
Yeah, and we talked about this too. You called out me saying fearless, and I've thought about that a lot in the couple of days since. And I think it's not about having no fear, right?
It's not about having no fear.
Yeah.
And I think that this concept of people to be an entrepreneur, you have to be fearless. You have to be able to jump without a parachute. You know,
maybe just stupid.
you jump without a parachute. Fine
line
you
between
die.
Fearless and stupidity.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we both have children and we both have, you know, people and environments that we care about.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so you can do things that are not so fucking big, but still feel really good about it.
Yeah.
And it's such a winner-take-all messaging that happens out there right now. You know, things are, I think, you know, when you're in such a world where things have to be diluted to what can be said in, you know, a certain number of characters.
Some might. So I love this format.
Yes.
Yeah.
This format, Substack, long-form writing, like it is so much better because just things are so rarely black or white.
I think, and don't want to get sidetracked into politics, but the political environment, but also COVID times, I think it really polarized thinking into right and wrong, black and white, and it allowed very little space for nuance. And I think we all know that actually 99% of things are gray, you know, somewhere between the black and white.
Well, and that's so true. And what is shocking, though, is, you know, here at Tibi, you know, we have 500,000 followers. I have 200 something thousand on my personal Instagram. And that's what I found so shocking was as polarized as things were always presented in the media, they were not at all polarized in my DMs. And I mean, I was getting DMs to the tune of like thousands a week.
Wow.
And I can count on one hand the number of DMs I got where people threw at me very like absolute statements. People were rabid, hungry for conversations that were, let's
totally explore
it. Wow.
Yeah.
And so when I talk about the danger of things getting too big as companies and everything, it's because you start reading the media wrong. You start reading the numbers wrong. And that's when.
Not to mention the algorithms.
The algorithm.
Right?
And I did a thing the other day on AI. Is like, it's either a two-faced bitch or it's a total sycophant.
Yeah.
It tells you what you want. And it is really by being able to connect with real people every time. People tend to be so shocked that people are normal. They're like, oh, this person's shockingly normal. This person was so shockingly nice to me on the plane.
Yeah.
And I'm like, when can we all stop being shocked that people are normal and they do want to have a conversation? And that is what needs to get talked about because
it's the quiet 95%,
yes,
right?
Yes. And they've all kind of gone underground and are having these very interesting conversations. But being small allows us to be part of that. And it being part of that conversation is what really, you know, when we talked about confidence of your gut, it's that's where so much of my gut confidence has come from.
You know, almost a million people at your,
And not knowing that I'm right, but knowing that I'll be able to explain myself.
That also comes from acting with integrity, I think, right? And I think we're a big part of our brand and me as a person is transparency. And I think
and
that gives
integrity?
You freedom. Well, integrity, acting.
It's like knowing your principles, right?
Knowing your principles, knowing that you're making a decision that you feel is right.
Right.
In that time. And I think it's...
In that time.
The
qualifier
is
so key. Information
you have.
Yes.
You know?
In that time. People forget that decisions are made in time and not reflective.
No, they're all contextual, right? Yes. You remove the context and...
And they mean nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Context
is everything.
It's everything.
But I do think if you have that integrity, people understand. Because I think, I don't know if you feel the same, but as a business owner, you know, there's always a fear that you'll put a foot wrong.
Yeah.
You know, unintentionally, because I don't think either of us would ever do something intentional. But there's always a little fear that, like, if I put a foot wrong.
Yeah.
And I think what you have to fall back on is that I've always operated with integrity. And if I put a foot wrong, I'll own up to it. And I will, you know, because there's so much, you know, our whole supply chain. There's always, I don't know what we'll look back on in 20 years' time and think, oh, we didn't realize that that meant that.
You will,
we just don't know.
I cannot be more clear than the fact that we absolutely will make mistakes.
100%.
And
yeah.
The biggest mistake would be you don't own up to it. You
don't own up to it.
Do the research later on to, you know.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you as a last question here. What would be your line that you would draw to, like, never go beyond? But it sounds like if anything really messed with your integrity, that would maybe be.
It's funny. I was awake in the night with jet lag and I was thinking about our company values, probably subconsciously thinking about the session. And I thought, why is integrity not one of our three values?
Because without it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's an underlying principle that informs all of the other three.
Yeah.
But I think that's at the heart of, you know, the other values like excellence and open-mindedness and, you know, but actually all of it needs to be done with integrity.
I was reading, there's a Substacker that I follow and I think the name of her Substack is Deeply Shallow. And she was commenting that one of the pain points she feels are the people who you catch your spouse. I'm going to butcher the way that she said this, but it's like you catch your spouse having an affair on your couch and you throw out the couch. You throw out the reminder rather than throwing out the spouse, you know? And that's
an extreme example, but you can see it playing out in smaller circumstances, right?
You just get rid of the reminder and then just like keep going on with.
Oh, I love that. I'm gonna ponder that one. You know,
I asked her, I wrote her, I'm like, did you have this analogy? And she's like, this is what my dad always said to us when we were little. And I was like, wow.
What was mom up to? It's so good though. So much easier to hide the evidence.
Exactly. And I think that's what is so important in a good company is you really you cannot mask things and you have to have people around you who are comfortable owning up to things, having discourse and comfortable with you making mistakes.
Yeah. And I think that's in some ways just the heart of it, right?
Yeah.
Comfortable celebrating them, even you know, ensuring that we learn from them.
Well, that's the beauty, like, too. I mean, especially in an industry, like when you're creating something where sometimes the mistakes make the best.
And like you say, when you have no playbook,
which
if you're trying to do things differently, you don't.
Yeah.
You can't help but make mistakes. Yeah. That's the only way. And what are those, that old saying of, you know, that's how a child learns to walk.
Yeah.
There's no way to learn to walk without falling over. It's true, right?
Yes, but you remind me, we went to this birthday party one time, and so I'm not going to name the city because it might give it away, but they had this massive basement, massive basement, like 2,000 square feet basement, huge.
Yeah.
And every inch of the basement was covered in gymnastic mats, those padded mats that you would see on a gymnastic floor. And I asked the woman, I said, are you guys like rabid gymnasts in this house? And she said, no, no, no. I would bring the babies down here when they were learning to walk.
Oh, God.
I was like, what the fuck? Like, she would only let them learn to walk on these gym mats.
I don't like to judge people, but I'm judging.
I know. Yeah. I was like, a baby. Yeah. Like, have you ever seen a baby fall? It's like, meek.
But also, like, we try to protect things too much. The baby's not going to learn, right? How much longer does it take to walk if you're just bumping around on the...
I mean, the kids have to be like 24 or 25 right now. So I'd like to do just like that Stanford marshmallow experiment where they check it. I'm like,
look back.
There's got to be like a gym mat experiment. And I want to see what those kids are doing right now. Are they risk takers or not?
Yeah, I can't see it.
If we were to sit back on this couch in 5 years...
It's a good length.
Good span, right? Yeah. Three's too short. Ten's way too long. 5 years. What would have happened that would make you sit on this couch and be like, oh, my God, Amy, this is where I am 5 years later. This is insane and amazing.
I think it goes back to that North Star. Like, if we're seeing a real shift in the industry, if people brands needed to label their ingredients, if there was more testing of safety of ingredients, and if we just are kind of shifting the knowledge gap around supply chain and perfume. And more importantly, there's a whole bunch of people who love how, you know, what we're doing and are part of this with us and feel part of the change. But I think I'd love to see really tangible change, actually.
So what's really interesting is your five-year amazingness, and you said tangible, but you didn't qualify tangible in terms of any product from you or any monetary level. So that really is a North Star. That is your North Star. You build it and the rest will come.
We need the product and the money for that to happen.
Yeah. But you're like, as long as the other thing happens, your 5 year happens, the rest falls into place.
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, it's never been about money for me. I don't know about you, but.
In the beginning, it kind of was, but more of a scorecard.
Yeah. It was always a scorecard. I can say that.
I mean, we very happy growing up in a house that my parents bought for $20,000 and a plot of land of 10. Like, life can be amazing. It was a scorecard.
It's the way we measure value.
It was also society. A Prada bag at the time, if I'm totally honest.
And it's a privilege not to worry about money.
Yes.
So I'm fully aware of that, but I'm just as aware of the fact that it's not going to solve problems.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's just like the quality of the, at some point, like, it becomes incremental and not adding the value that you thought that it would.
Yeah.
And it actually can take away tremendously.
And you see that.
Yeah.
You
see it all the time. So thank you for being on the show. We'll book you back here in 5 years.
Yes. Hold me accountable, Amy.
We'll do it in New Zealand.
I'll come in my fancy car.
I want to do it in New Zealand.
She's changed.
She pulls up. She's like, I'm sorry, I can't do the show. You, my writer, my green room.
Where's my personal assistant? No, it's been a real privilege. Thank you.
Oh, very cool.